to coincide with this talk because I had to put my sweater on. I'd like to first thank Martin for inviting me to present this talk. What I'll be presenting is the work that's been conducted over three field seasons, and I was part of an international collaboration, and I really have to acknowledge my co-authors, and they're really co-authors and collaborators that worked really hard with me in the field work that we did. Ashley Sparrow is in Alice Springs, Australia with CSIRO. David Hopkins is with Harry Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. Laurie Greenfield is at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. Phil Novus is also in Christchurch at Landcare Research, and Bo Elberling is with the University of Copenhagen. I guess to start off, I need to sort of set the context and describe to you what an Antarctic dry valley is, in case you don't know. This is a photo of the Wright Valley in the summertime, the astral summer, and it looks the weather's pretty benign and it looks pretty comfortable. And these were, the dry valleys were discovered by Scott and his expedition to the South Pole, and when they first came across these, one of the members of the expedition was so excited that he thought this would be a great place to grow spuds. The excitement kind of wore off later on in a subsequent trip that Scott conducted. He said that these were valleys of dead and in which we'd not seen any life at all. And I think he was probably kind of grumpy because they had this was a real impediment when you're hauling ice sledges across the ice to come across these dry, barren, dry valleys. To really understand the dry valleys, you have to sort of understand the physiography of the whole system, actually the continent. Antarctica, of course, is quite large. It's the size of the United States and Mexico combined. The Ross Ice Shelf down here is about the size of France. And the dry valleys are in the McMurdo Sound region in southern Victoria Land. They comprise an area of about 15,000 square kilometers and are bounded on the west side by the Trans-Antarctic Mountains and on the east side by the Ross Sea. The Ross Island is where the United States and New Zealand have their base stations. McMurdo is the U.S. station. Scott Base is the one that I operated out of with my team at Scott Base. And we worked primarily in Garwood Valley, which is about 80 kilometers away from the base camp. You're probably familiar with the long-term ecological research site in Taylor Valley. That was established in 1993. And there's extensive terrestrial research that's been done in the Wright Valley as well. So to really understand, as I say, it's important to understand the physiography, the dimensions, the physical layout of things at a continental scale to understand the dry valleys themselves. So on the bottom panel, this is an elevation cross-section from point A to point B in this top one diagram. And it illustrates two reasons why the dry valleys are dry. First of all, the Trans-Antarctic Mountains block the polar ice sheet from moving down into the coastal regions where the dry valleys are located. Secondly, the elevation is higher in the central part of the continent, and that elevation drops off very quickly, and that produces winds, some very cold, dry winds which come blowing down across the ice sheet and into the dry valleys. And this pretty much tells you what the dry valleys are looking like. Very dry, of course, and there's low precipitation relative to evaporation and sublimation, low albedo, and these dry katabatic winds tend to blow the snow around and blow it away. Some of the valleys are very large, tens of kilometers long, several kilometers wide. This is a photo of the Wright Valley in Lake Vanda, in which the Onyx River flows into Lake Vanda from the coastal regions. It flows inland. And the temperature of the dry valleys is pretty consistent with what we see here in the Wright Valley. Mean annual temperature of minus 20 degrees Celsius. Mean annual precipitation of less than 50 millimeters in some of the valleys. Some, it's up to 100 millimeters of water equivalent. And it mainly falls in the form of snow. There are smaller dry valleys, and these are fairly small in size, and they're oriented in different directions, which is important with respect to the melting that occurs. In astral summer starts about late November to February. There's a lot of the soil temperature increases to up to about 15 degrees Celsius on warm days. There's a fair amount of melting then that occurs, and the meltwater comes off the glaciers and runs through the valley bottoms. And so these, and you can see here, this is the Transantarctic Mountains blocking that polar ice sheet, but there are glaciers that are coming down off of the sides. And the polar ice sheet responds to climate change on the order of hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of years, because it's a one big sheet of ice. But the dry valleys are very sensitive to solar radiation and can respond to temperature very quickly. In a matter of days, actually, when the sun is blocked or obscured, the melting flows down and the water flows drop considerably. So the dry valleys are extreme members of cold, arid terrestrial ecosystems. They're polar deserts. And so in a polar desert, the liquid to ice phase is critical to biota, whereas in other deserts, it's a liquid to vapor phase that's critical to biota. Unlike other ecosystems, the dry valleys are dominated by microorganisms, lichens, and mosses. There's very few invertebrates, so the trophic chain is fairly small or fairly simple. So this results in low diversity and low small biomass. The soils themselves are shallow and have little structure, have little available water, so therefore the primary productivity is low, and that means that the soils have little soil organic matter. So the carbon cycle is relatively simple in these as well. So outline of my talk, I want to present some description of the origin of soil organic matter. There's two types of models that describe this, a legacy model, which is a sort of a characterization of the temporal subsidies of organic matter. And then there's evidence, another model called spatial subsidy of soil organic matter, which is from aquatic systems supplying the organic matter to the outlying areas. I also want to talk about the landforms and soil types that are common in the dry valleys. And then I want to describe an experiment that we conducted, a substrate addition experiment we conducted to look at resource limitations on microbial activity. So to start with the legacy model, this model states that in many thousands of years ago, there was the climate in the area was much warmer, there was higher precipitation, the glaciers were more active, moving down into the lower areas, there was higher snow melt, higher stream flow, more water accumulating in these low-lying areas. So the lakes themselves were higher, warmer, with more productivity of algal material, and that material then deposited on the lake beds. Then as the climate changed to a more colder environment, there was less precipitation, lower stream flow, but the evaporation still remained relatively high. So that caused the lake to dry up and expose the bed deposits. Then there are spatial subsidies from aquatic environments. As I mentioned, the streams and lakes and ponds in the dry valley are very critical, important features. And there's algal growth and cyanobacteria that are actively photosynthesizing and fixing nitrogen during the summer months. And then when these organisms die, you can see the remains of them by the foam on the shorelines. And this detritus material is moved across the landscape in the low-lying areas by the level of the lake. And you can see strand lines of lacustrine detritus. And here's five distinct strand lines that the organic matter has been moved by the water up the landscape and across. And some of this material can be up to 40 meters away. So we collected some of this material at different, these are three different landscape elements, different landforms in the valley. Collected detritus in these strand lines at different distances away from the water, and then ran a mineralization experiment, and this is expressing the mineralization as a per gram of carbon in the material. You can see that the decomposition decreases with increasing distance away from the source of the water, and this is consistent with the fact that the oldest organic matter is furthest away, and it's been subjected to decomposition over time. There's also a lot of cyanobacterial growth, nostoc, which grows along the edges of water bodies, and you can see it in these dark patches along the lake shore. And these can be quite thick and dark, and they can be up to 1 to 2 centimeters thick, and that's exposed when the lake level drops down, and then it dries out, and it basically freeze dries, and then when the wind picks up, it just blows it away, and you can see some of this stuff just blows off in big sheets of material blowing across the landscape. And we set out to measure how far this was distributed, and we set out some highly sophisticated sediment traps, basically cake pans, and put them out 1 year, and then the next year we came back and we could identify the lacustrine deposits, lacustrine material that had been blown across the landscape. We looked at respiration across the landscapes. We looked at in different landscape elements, different landforms. We took respiration measurements across large transects going away from the water up to several hundred meters away from the lakes, and these are two different landforms. And you can see a strong decreasing trend in respiration as you move away from that, from the water source. And that's consistent then with the fact that the quantity and the biological availability of that material, of the organic matter, is decreasing with distance from the lake as well. So there's important to, again, consider the physical attributes, the size, the orientation, the shape of the lakes, because that, of the dry valleys, that then affects the landforms, and those landforms are important with respect to soil type and how the carbon cycling occurs. And this is a schematic of the Garwood Valley that we worked in. It's about 7 square kilometers. It's bounded at both ends by a glacier, two different glaciers, and the lake is a predominant feature in the dry valley with feeder streams coming in. And we could identify 8 distinct landforms which have a distinct soil type in those areas. And I'll just go through some of those areas just to show you what it looks like. This is the lake, and you can see that there's a lot of alluvial material on the sides, delta material, sands that have washed in. There's glaciers at the high end of the far end of the valley. And this is where the sand accumulates in large sand dunes. This is the evidence of the effect of katabatic winds blowing that sand up against the glaciers, accumulating in these large sand dunes. At the other end, there's a glacier, and you can see that it's pushing two separate moraines here. And this is very coarse, gravelly, rocky material. And then there's this delta of alluvial material, and there's a campsite here. This is where we conducted this substrate addition experiment that I'll describe later on. And this is a close-up of it showing the alluvial material in polygons. This is where the soil is freezing and thawing repeatedly. As I said, we distinguished 8 soil types and landforms, and I'll just show you 4 of them here just to give you an idea of the types of material that are in each of them. In the upper left, there's the fan polygon. This alluvial material is in those polygon shapes. The upper right shows delta material, which is coarse, sandy material and is very unstable because of the water that's coming off the glaciers and it moves around. And then there's the fine sandy material in those dunes, and it's quite thick. The soils can be quite thick in that region. And then there's those morainal soils that I mentioned before. And the material here is quite heterogeneous. It ranges from boulders to rocks to small stones and sand and fine sand. So it's quite variable. We went out and did some measurements, several different types of measurements, but I just want to show you the soil water and carbon measurements that we made in each of these landscapes. We looked at 5 replicate areas in each of the 8 landscape elements. And you can see that the water content, of course, varies from very dry, less than 5%, up to almost 30% just a few meters away from the lake. The carbon follows this trend as well, ranging from just a few tenths of a gram of carbon per kilogram of soil up to 30 grams of carbon per kilogram of soil. And then the basal respiration in these in situ measurements shows that, again, a wide range of respiration is occurring in these environments, but detectable at all landscape levels that we could identify. And the upshot of this is that the dry valleys are very heterogeneous. There's a range of properties. Nitrogen follows the same trend. Several orders of magnitude can be obvious in the properties that we're measuring. So the important part is that these valleys can't be treated as a single unit. You really have to look at it from a geomorphological perspective to really get an idea of what's going on with respect to carbon cycling. We had enough in situ soil respiration measurements, and we also collected soil samples, brought them back to the lab, and ran some temperature incubation studies. So we were able to construct estimates, get some estimates of seasonal soil respiration, and from this then we calculated the turnover time of these soils in the Garwood, and for 7 out of 8 sites, the turnover time ranged between 60 to 120 years. And this is much faster than would be predicted if it was all legacy carbon. And these fast turnover times imply that the legacy carbon is either about to be exhausted or that it's not participating in contemporary carbon cycling due to the fact that it's either protected or it's relative, very recalcitrant material. And if this is true, then the carbon cycling that we're seeing is either largely sustained, if not all completely sustained, by modern sources of organic matter. There's some work that's been done in the Taylor Valley to look at this legacy carbon in some detail, and I wanted to show this picture that we took that goes across Lake Bonnie and is across on the other side of the valley, and you can see distinct lines showing the former lakeshore. The level of the lake was much higher, up to, they estimate this lake was present between 12 and 15,000 years ago. So these are some data to show the isotopic composition of potential sources of organic matter of this legacy carbon. And it's showing that the marine algal material, lacustrine material, and endoliths organic matter has distinct delta N15 and C13 ratios. The marine algae is enriched in N15. The endolith organic matter, and that's organic matter that's embedded in the sandstone and associated with rocks. That organic matter is very depleted in N15, and it's also depleted in C13 relative to the lacustrine material. So there was research done to assess the soils, the source of this organic matter, and when they collected the soils and measured the isotopic composition of those soils, it ranged across all three sources of organic matter. The red dots here are is the isotopic composition of the material that we collected from strand lines, and also the blue dots here represent the material that we collected in windborne sediments. And when we incubated the soils from the dry valley or from Garwood Valley and measured the del value of the CO2 from a long-term incubation, that fell right within the range of this lacustrine material. So that actively cycling organic carbon is predominantly coming from lacustrine sources. I want to show you a graphic depiction then of the spatial subsidies, of how spatial subsidies of organic matter occur in the dry valleys. So fluvial processes move the water and the nutrients into the low-lying areas. There's algal growth, cyanobacterial growth, along the edges of the streams and lakes. This material washes up or is freeze-dried. And then the wind, as I said, picks this material up and blows it away. So this is a aquatic to terrestrial source-sink relationship. And this aquatic to terrestrial source-sink relationship is important because it links the biogeochemical cycles across the terrestrial and aquatic systems. And this is an important feature of the ecosystems of the dry valley and the way they function. In temperate ecosystems, of course, things tend to move downhill. The source-sink relationship is terrestrial to aquatic, and the flows are characterized by downward flow and leaching and erosion. In the dry valleys, the source-sink goes the other way. The aquatic to terrestrial flows go through, are from the lake and go uphill through the lacustrine detritus. So if these spatial subsidies are important, we wanted to look at them in an experiment in a field study to assess the soil response to the additions of different substrates and determine if any response was related to carbon and or nitrogen supply. So we conducted an experiment on those polygon soils in four polygon blocks, and this is alluvial material, and we applied two levels of carbon and nitrogen in simple and complex forms. Here's a photograph of the experimental site showing the chambers. They're a little PVC pipe. They were 10 centimeters in diameter, 10 centimeters long, and we inserted them 7 centimeters into the soil. And then we measured respiration using a Lycor 6200. And we also measured water content and temperature at each location. This is just a graphic to show the experimental design. So we had a simple source of carbon, which was glucose. Simple source of nitrogen was ammonium chloride. And then we had what we called complex substrates, amino acid, glycine, and the detritus, the lacustrine detritus. This graph just shows that we applied the simple substrates either singly or in combination. So the single rates of 1 and 10 grams of carbon per kilogram of soil or nitrogen with the ammonium chloride, so going from low to high. And then we had a combination of low carbon, low nitrogen, low carbon, high nitrogen, and high carbon, high nitrogen. The complex substrates were applied not in combination, but just singly at either 1 or 10 milligrams or 10 grams per kilogram of soil. So before we applied the substrate, we measured the respiration at time zero, and then at 2 days after application of the substrates. And this shows that there was no response at all across any of the substrates after 2 days of in the field. But by day four, there was a significant response primarily to nitrogen. And even at the low rate of nitrogen, there was a significant response. Numbers in the treatment boxes represent the respiration rate expressed relative to the control. So this low nitrogen response was 9 times that of the control, and it was 16 times that in the high nitrogen treatment. And the high nitrogen, high carbon treatments also had a significant response. 6 days after the application of the substrates, there was the same picture appears. Low nitrogen and high nitrogen had about 21 times higher respiration in the high nitrogen treatment than in the control. Then 2 years after the application of the substrate, we came back to the site and measured respiration again. And at this point, then, we could see a significant response in the complex substrates. The amino acid and the lacustrine detritus were about 3 to 5 times greater than that in the control, and the combination of high nitrogen and carbon also was significant. Then 3 years after the application of the substrate, we came back, sampled the soils, kept them cold, and then brought them back to the lab, sieved them, and then we moistened them up to 20% water holding capacity and incubated them for 7 days at 10 degrees C, which is about the highest temperature that we recorded in the field. And after this 7 day period, we could see a significant response in almost all of the treatments. The ammonium chloride, the glucose, and the amino acid all showed significant response. The high carbon, high nitrogen treatment was 22 times higher than that of the control. So the conclusions of this is that the response to all substrates was relatively slow, relatively weak, but there was a significant response to simple nitrogen substrates. The widespread response was evident after a long period of time, after 2 to 3 years. We could see that response. And the upshot of this is that the microbial community is nitrogen limited, but if this limitation is alleviated, they can access a small pool that they couldn't metabolize before. And the other thing that's important from this study, again, to show the spatial constraints of the substrate with the organism, is that the effects of the carbon and nitrogen on respiration under the laboratory conditions were faster, and there was a more significant response than those in situ. And this highlights the spatial constraint that the organisms face. They don't have access to that, and this was alleviated when we sieved the soils and mixed them up for the incubation. So with that, I'll close, but I need to acknowledge the funding agencies. Antarctic New Zealand was primarily the funded most of our research on this project, but we had other sources as well. And with that, I'll close and entertain questions.
Thank you very much, Ed. Yes, we have time for questions.
You added 10 grams of nitrogen per kilogram soil in the nitrogen.
Sorry, 10 milligrams.
10 milligrams.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, but, and for the carbon, it was 10.
One to 10 milligrams of carbon as well.
Okay, they're all okay.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. Sorry, it was milligrams, not grams.
Okay, it was like, wait, that's a lot.
Yeah. Peter?
Yeah, so when you do a long-term experiment like this and you've got all that potential for cyanobacteria to grow, did you see any evidence that they were responding to some of the nitrogen alone additions and they became the carbon that...
Yeah, we didn't see any of that because we were far enough away from the wet areas. So we were up away, quite a ways, I would guess about 200 meters away from the shore of the lake. So that, yeah. Yeah?
You work mostly in the top few centimeters of the soil, is that correct?
Yeah, well, when we collected the samples for the carbon, it was down to 5 centimeters depth that we collected the carbon to. And then when we took the respiration measurements, we mixed it to 5 centimeters deep as well into the soil. And then we had the PVC pipe was about 7 centimeters into the soil.
Do you have any ideas what might be occurring deeper in the soil? And I guess the first question that I would have is, was there any accumulation of clay in this soil?
The texture does change. You have a gravel mulch at the surface, and then it does get finer. But the permafrost at this level was about 20 centimeters deep. So your active layer is only about 20 centimeters on the experimental site. But you're right, the texture does change with depth in these soils, in the experimental site.
Did you also look to microbial community composition in your fertilizer experiment?
No, we didn't. No. So I've got soils if you want to.
Any questions? Yes.
This is a bit off topic, yeah. But is there any signs of energy and carbon reactions in the soils?
Some of the soil types, yes, they do. There is some. And this is calcium carbonates. Quite a bit, yeah. We didn't quantify it. We could distinguish it. All of our measurements were done on acidified. When we looked at organic carbon, of course, we acidified it to make sure we didn't have any of those things.
Could any of the CO2 be being released from the carbonate?
It could be. We just didn't make any attempt to look at that, yeah.
Questions or comments, or maybe questions for the previous speakers as well?
Just one quick follow-up on that thought, that if you're stimulating microbial activity, might you be stimulating some acid production as well,
yeah,
sort of mobilizing organic carbon?
Yeah, it could be. They're alkaline soils around the, up to about pH 8 in the experimental site. Some are quite high in pH, but yeah.
So I just follow that logic out. Did you see any nitrate accumulating? Or did you look for
that? We didn't look at nitrogen, nitrate. We measured nitrate in the organic matter study where we characterized the carbon and the different landscape elements, and there's a fair amount of nitrate present in some of the soil.
Questions, maybe for previous speakers as well. If there are no questions, I will just thank Ed for his excellent presentation. It's now time for a break, so the session resumes at 10:20. Be there. Again, still quite.
Thank you.